continuing on aim, we talked about how one way you can improve your blood fluidity. Actually, we've talked about three areas. Does anyone remember any of them? By the way, if you're not remembering any of them, it's just showing you're in the right place. So this is good. Yeah, that's right. One of them is drinking more water. That's right. Drinking more water. Well, exercise is coming up. We did allude to that. Donating blood, exactly right. That was the first thing we talked about. You weren't here then, okay. And then the other one was? Yes, eating more plant food. So those are the first three. We're going through 10 areas, and the fourth one we're going to talk about is achieving and maintaining an ideal weight. Some of you have been talking with me about this one. Okay. So weight reduction, as we put it here, is at the intersection of activity and healthy diet. We spoke some about nutrition. Let's look, though, at how weight influences blood fluidity. So this is another study from that journal, Clinical Hemorheology and Microcirculation. This is a study from Spain. They compared 136 overweight people with 136 normal weight people. And they found that the overweight individuals had higher levels of inflammation in their body. That's measured by something called C-reactive protein. They also found a number of factors that worsened their blood fluidity in those overweight individuals. You've heard about all these if you've been here the last few days. Fibrinogen, that clotting protein, was higher. Remember, that impairs blood fluidity. Plasma viscosity was higher. The higher the viscosity, the poorer the blood flow. And erythrocyte aggregation, remember, that's the tendency of red blood cells to clump together. All those were worse as individuals gained weight. There's a connection between carrying extra weight and having poorer blood fluidity. Here's how the authors summarized things. They said these rheologic alterations, that means these abnormalities in hemorheology or blood fluidity, relate both to two things going on at least, insulin resistance and inflammation. So to try to make this simple, what these researchers are finding, as well as others, is that when we carry extra weight, it causes insulin not to work as well in our bodies. That, of course, puts us at increased risk for diabetes. But even if you never develop diabetes, maybe genetically, you've just got a great pancreas. You're going to never have diabetes, but as the insulin levels ramp up in your body, that's what happens if you have insulin resistance. Your pancreas has to make more insulin. As those insulin levels ramp up, the blood clotting becomes perturbed, or the blood fluidity is worsened. Inflammation. We've talked a bit about this. The fat that you carry, especially around the middle, is metabolically active. The fat is making compounds that actually make the body have more inflammation in it. So a lot of times you'll go see your doctor, let's say you have knee pain, you have arthritis, osteoarthritis of the knees, the doctor will say lose weight and that will help your knees. Well, that's true for more than one reason. It's not just that you're putting less stress on the knee. It's also true that you're decreasing inflammatory compounds in the body. And if you weren't here earlier when I talked about this, this subject is not to make anyone feel guilty. Because just by looking at any one of you, I don't know whether you're doing great or you're doing poorly in the weight control department. You say, well, Dr. Rose, I don't know what's the matter with you because I see that person over there. They're doing really bad. I can tell just by looking at them. No, you can't tell. Because if they weren't on such a good lifestyle, they may weigh 700 pounds. And I'm going to shock all of you right now. But my highly honed clinical skills tell me, without knowing anything about any of your weight, that no one in this room weighs 700. Are you impressed? But you understand my point. You understand my point. Just because you think someone is carrying extra weight, you don't know anything about their lifestyle. You don't know what they're doing. You say, well, I know if they weigh that much, they must be eating on the sly. Well, not necessarily. So the point is, this is not a moral issue. It's not for us in the church to decide, well, this person, you know, we can't have them be the head deaconess because they weigh too much. Or They can't be an elder because they're too big around. That's not the point. We don't, do you understand what I'm saying? So we're not trying to, what we're trying to say though is if you're carrying extra weight, it does worsen blood fluidity. And the question should be, if you feel like you're carrying some extra weight, can I trim down a bit? Because even making small changes in your weight can definitely improve blood fluidity. And by the way, because it's the fat that's bad, even if your weight doesn't change, if you tone up, and we're going to look at that, if you start getting more fit, this improves blood fluidity. But that's the next point. So we've been talking about this, and this is just some more summary statement that about how obesity itself and that abdominal fat worsens blood fluidity. By the way, if this is your first time in the presentations, all of these materials that I'm showing are available to you. So you just send me an email. If you didn't get my email address earlier, some of my business cards are sitting up there. Or if you feel better, I'll put them on the white table over here. And you can pick one of those up. Send me an email. Those of you that sent me emails yesterday have gotten the materials that I've released. What I'm doing is I'm releasing the materials as we finish sections. So all of the material on that we gave on Sunday dealing with ancient secrets, modern health, we've made that available. Okay, so everyone, if you sent me an email yesterday, if you sent it today, I'm still getting caught up. So just send me an email, we can send that. And by the way, the other good news is you have a very accommodating conference here. Are you aware of that? And Kara Lyons has said that for me to send her all the electronic copies. So if you have trouble reaching Dr. DeRose, then you just send her an email. She'll have electronic copies. And you say, well, I don't do anything with the internet. Well, the next time you're over at the Minnesota conference office, you just ask her for a hard copy. She'll give it to you. I mean, understandably, they can't be mailing out, you know, all kinds of copies all over the conference. But I thought she was being very gracious because the last camp meeting I was at, if they couldn't get the handouts from me, they didn't get them from anybody. Okay? Well, so this point that we've already made, if you lose body fat, it improves blood fluidity. Now, here's a shocking one for you. This is a study now, the very same journal, but this is in not overweight individuals, but who? They're studying athletes now. And what they found, even in athletes, people who were fit, highly fit, if they could lose more body fat, their blood fluidity improved further. Now, by the way, some of you in this room may be too thin. This doesn't mean that you're supposed to just waste away to nothing. We're talking about toning up and even, you know, getting rid of extra body fat. But the point I'm sharing here, these people didn't have huge amounts of weight to lose, and even small changes in weight, decreasing body fat, can make a difference. So don't get discouraged if you can't lose the 100 pounds that you think you need to lose. If you can lose 10, that's going to help you. Maybe I should mention this to you because I think it's important. Some of you heard me say earlier this week that I used to run a weight loss program in a large hospital system. One of the most distressing things to me in that role was to see people do very well in the area of weight loss, but not get down to this magic weight that they thought they were supposed to weigh or wanted to weigh. You may, because of your genetics, because of what happened in the womb, or some of you heard this more than once this week. You may hear it again. But we now know that intrauterine factors predispose you to things like high blood pressure and diabetes and obesity and other problems. And no one's going to blame you for what happened in the womb. You understand? So the point is, some of us are going to be thinner or heavier than we'd like. Some of you may be looking at me and you say, Dr. DeRose, you need to gain some weight. Well, here's my approach. Try to stick with as good a lifestyle as you can, and your weight will tend to equilibrate at what an optimal weight is based on your genetics and intrauterine factors and early life history. And if it's too thin for you, well, some of us have to deal with that. If it's too heavy for you, some of you have to deal with that. But just focus on the lifestyle. Do you see my point? If that doesn't sound like good news, you didn't listen to my presentation on changing bad habits for good. I was reassured to hear that some of you actually, the last time I was here, you listened to that presentation, you got my DVD, and someone was telling me, Dr. DeRose, I faithfully keep that DVD on my shelf. I said, well, you need to look at it again. What you're talking about, you need to watch that DVD again. Okay, you got the point, though. Let's trim down fat mass as much as we can, even within a physiologic range, even though it's normal. People aren't obese. If you can do that, it's going to help the blood fluidity. These athletes theoretically could perform better. Well, how do you do it? One way is to make exercise a priority. And you can see what I recommend, exercising how often? Daily. Now, some people find this shocking. But I've never had a patient find it shocking if I told them that as a general principle, I wanted them to eat every day. You don't find that shocking? How about if I told you I recommend all my patients sleep every day? Is that, you think that would be a strange recommendation to hear from a doctor? No, you say this is obvious. Well, what I try to encourage people to think in terms of, it's another day, it's not a question of whether I will exercise or not, what's the question? Yeah, when or what? You know, the best thing is if you just have a regular habit that you do it at a certain time. To me, the most controllable time of my day is early in the morning. So that's when I get out and exercise. I will tell you, there have been times in my life where that was not the most controllable time of my day, and I exercise at other times. So it just depends on your schedule. Make a priority of doing something, whether it's a group sport or whether it's an individual activity. Let's look at why this is. Aerobic exercise, that means exercise where you use your large muscle groups and your heart and your lungs. So whether it's walking or swimming or bicycling or cross-country skiing or ice skating or snowshoeing or shoveling snow, whatever it might be, okay? Those things are aerobic exercises. Now, you can overdo, but appropriate aerobic exercise improves blood fluidity, and the more you exercise, the better your blood fluidity tends to get. Again, within physiologic realms. If you're very out of shape, maybe one shovel full of snow is too much. Right? And exercise, of course, also improves blood fluidity by decreasing fat mass. And I notice when people get on a good fitness program, you know, fitness alone and exercise usually do not help you lose that much weight, but they do help you tone up and build muscle mass. So you need to change your diet as well as your exercise or your meal timing if you want to lose weight significantly. This is now a review, it's in medical language. What it's telling us here is that if you get patients to do exercise training, let's just read it and then I'll summarize it for you. Studies show that exercise training in patients suffering from metabolic and or cardiovascular disorders, such as the insulin resistance syndrome, results in a parallel improvement of metabolism, risk factors, blood rheology, and fitness. So what they're trying to say in plain English, and we don't speak in plain English, you know, when we're writing research papers, of which I've done some. They're saying is, look, you start doing exercise. It's not just going to help you lower things like cholesterol. It's not only going to improve your metabolism, lower things like blood sugar, but it's also going to improve your blood fluidity that we typically don't measure. And you all know it's going to help you improve your fitness. Now, this is really interesting. We look at exercise and obesity and how they interrelate when it comes to blood fluidity. And this is really good news for those of you who've been frustrated in your weight loss attempts. This is a paper published over a decade ago out of the Cooper Clinic. And these researchers were some of the first ones I know of, maybe the very first, to start speaking about this continuum between fitness and fatness, or this controversy, if you will. Here's how it works. It works like this. If you had to choose, you can only pick one or the other. If you can only choose one, what should you choose? To be fit and fat, or to be thin and unfit? What would be the better choice? Yeah, fit and fat is better. That's out of this research. And so they're going to look at this, and they're going to look at some of the blood fluidity factors and why this might be. So they're looking at associations of fitness and fatness to some things that affect hemorheology or blood fluidity. One of them is this protein fibrinogen. Another one's the white blood cell count. We haven't talked much about that, but the higher your white blood cell count, the poorer your blood fluidity. And I probably should mention this. One of you who's a dietitian was talking with me after the last lecture, and we were just kind of comparing notes. And one thing that we see invariably is a person gets on a better lifestyle. How many of you know what happens to their white count if you get on a better lifestyle? The white count goes down. So if you're a smoker, you quit smoking, the white count drops dramatically. If you're eating meat and you stop eating meat, what happens to your white count? It goes down. Now you're getting worried. Dr. DeRose, if my white count goes down, what happens if I get an infection? Well, if you get an infection, your white count will go up. Okay? And the analogy I use when I'm explaining this to people is the white blood cells are like police cars in your body. How many of you like police cars? We're kind of an ambivalent group here. Well, let me give you a scenario. You tell me if you like this. Let's say you're going home after camp meeting. By the way, are all of you planning to go home after camp meeting? Maybe some of you live right here. But let's say you live 2 hours away. And so you get in your car and you're driving back home on Sunday after camp meeting. And as you're driving home, you just start noticing more and more police cars. By the time you come to your neighborhood, I mean, the police cars are just swarming all over. And immediately you're thinking, this is great. I'm finally glad they stepped up the police protection in my community. Is that what you're thinking? What are you thinking? Something's wrong. Well, this is how you should think about a white count. If your white count is running high, or should I say, even high normal, or maybe I should even go so far as to say even average, because realize, when we set average levels for the white count, we're looking at a bunch of sick people. You know what they're called? They're called Americans. Really? And so, if you get on a good lifestyle, almost without exception, your white count, unless you're dealing with some disease or some other issues, your white count is going to be low normal to maybe even low. So just keep that in mind. I'm telling you all this because the high white count is also harmful for your blood fluidity. What I'm going to do is just read you some summary statements, and I'll show you some pictures. Higher levels of fitness can prevent some undue hemorheologic effects even if a person is overweight. So what we're going to find is there's some of the things that affect blood fluidity. If you exercise, even if you don't lose a pound, it's going to help your blood fluidity. Okay? But having said that, achieving a desirable weight or losing some weight if you're overweight is necessary to optimize other blood fluidity factors. So let's look at this in some detail. This is a graph right out of that paper, that 2002 paper. It's looking at fibrinogen. I'm going to take a little bit of poetic license with this. If you're a scientist, you can just read this and figure it out. But try to make it as simple as I can. What they're doing is they're looking at fibrinogen. It's a clotting factor. The more of it you've got, the worse your blood fluidity. The group that's the worst, low fitness, intersecting with obesity, do you see where they're at? They have the worst, the highest fibrinogen level. You see how that works? Now, you want to see something interesting. If you're at high fitness, it really doesn't matter what your weight is. Your fibrinogen level will tend to be low. Okay? So, but this should motivate you. If you're overweight, you say, I've tried exercise before, I can't lose weight, and I just forget it, it's not worth the time. It is worth the time. If you're overweight, and the only reason that you're exercising was to improve your weight and it didn't work, well, I'm telling you, that's not the only reason to exercise. You can improve your blood fluidity just by being more active. So, you say, well, this is reassuring, Dr. DeRose. My doctor said I needed to lose 200 pounds, but I'm going to just go and say, Dr. DeRose said I do not need to lose a pound, I just need to be more fit. Well, before you come to that conclusion, there's another graph. Now, this graph is looking at the white blood cell count. And what I want you to notice is, yes, again, the worst group were those who were obese and low fitness. They're here. They're the worst off as having high weight counts. But what do you notice here? This time, even if you're at high fitness, as your weight goes up, the weight count tends to go up. Put another way, the person with low fitness, normal weight, is as good, maybe even a tendency to be a little bit better off than a person who has high fitness and is obese. Okay? Can't really say that from this data, but you get the point by looking at it. What am I saying? I'm saying exercise every day. You say, Dr. Jones, I don't care what you say. I don't have enough time to exercise. You don't realize how busy I am. Well, let me ask you a question. How much time do you have to spend in exercise to get a measurable physical benefit? I've actually looked through the literature on this question. I haven't looked at every exercise study. There's thousands upon thousands of them, perhaps millions of them. But I've looked at a number of them. I was trying to find what is the smallest amount of time that's actually been studied that shows a measurable benefit from exercise. Okay, 15 minutes, some say. 10 minutes, wow. You're optimistic. 30 minutes? 20? 6 minutes has been shown to measurably... Now, I'm not saying even 3 minutes wouldn't do you good. You got a question about this? And how many minutes does that take? Okay, so he's telling about how his daughter is in great shape. What? She doesn't run, and she does a fast walk for 10 or 15 minutes. Now, for many people, that's not adequate. I mean, I can't say whether it's adequate for your daughter or not. But the point is, even as little as 6 minutes, and I'm sure if they studied it, maybe even 3 or 4 or 5. And this is moderate exercise. It shows a measurable benefit to your immune system. This is interesting, isn't it? Now, if you're so busy that you can't squeeze in 6 minutes of exercise, come and talk with me afterward. Because you'd be the first person that honestly came to me, and I've shared this data with many people, no one has had the courage to come up to me and say, Dr. DeRose, I'm so busy, I can't even squeeze in 6 more minutes. Well, if you're that busy, can you afford to get sick? Well, then you better get the 6 minutes in. Improve your immune system. Well, there's more benefits to exercise, too, when it comes to blood fluidity. And remember, this is all related to brain health. Some of you are here for the first time. You're saying, what does this have to do with brain health? We spent our first session on Sunday speaking about how blood fluidity is involved with so many things, but among others, it's involved with lowering the risk of stroke and improving cognitive performance. So the better your blood fluidity, the clearer your mind is. And if you're having trouble understanding that, that's good because it means you're in the right place. See? Some of you don't even get my joke. You really? Okay, so stress raises these compounds that make blood fluidity worse. And exercise helps to relieve stress. That's another reason. Even if you can't lose weight, exercise helps you have a more even temper. Are you aware of that? Doesn't matter what type of exercise you choose. What do you think? Doesn't matter. Some of you are shaking your heads no. Since we're talking about this, I will tell you, if you're trying to lose weight, exercise that's not weight-bearing is not as efficient in losing weight as weight-bearing exercise. So if you swim for exercise, expending the same number of calories, you will not tend to lose as much weight as if you walk for exercise. Now, if you have bad joints, you may need to swim, right? With bad knees, all I can do is swim. Well, then swim. You understand what I'm saying. But if you're bearing more weight-bearing exercise, of course, that more weight-bearing exercise is also more beneficial for your bone health. And most of you are aware of that. So, of course, there's a number of applications of this, but what I want to look at you with is this statement here. Some of you were introduced to this earlier. Question is, does it matter what exercise you do? In one sense, it doesn't, and in another sense, it does. We talked about the does part. Here's where it doesn't. Go out and exercise how often? every day. Even though some things indoors have to be neglected. Do you know what my life today is? It's a little devotional book. It's a collection of things that Ellen White wrote. So it's not Dr. Giroux telling you to go out and exercise every day. Who is it? It's God through his more contemporary prophet. Go out and exercise every day. But you say, but I live in Minnesota, Dr. Giroux, not in California. That's why you have a mall. So a mall is a good option, but if you live in the country, that's why they made things like snowshoes and cross-country skis and ice skates. And believe me, I'm speaking from some experience, and some of you heard me. I told you I started to get on a regular exercise program when I was living in Minnesota, and I lived in rural Maine and other places where it gets cold. So, I mean, I can relate to you. I'm not saying it's necessarily the first thing you want to do when it's, you know, 30 below. And it's snowing, but go out and exercise every day. I'll let you read into that what you want to read. My life today, again, page 136, morning exercise and walking in the free, invigorating air of heaven or cultivating flowers, small fruits, and vegetables is necessary. Is what? Necessary to a healthful circulation of the blood. What is she talking about here? Well, she's talking about hemorheology. That was the answer I was looking for. Healthful circulation of blood. Optimal blood circulation. Optimal blood fluidity. And she goes on to say it's the surest safeguard against colds, coughs, and 100 other diseases. I'm telling you, this isn't poetry. This is reality. This is what modern science is showing us. It improves your immune system. It lowers your risk of cancer. Yes. And by the way, if you didn't come to that first presentation on the Methuselah factor, it's actually all on the DVD. In fact, maybe even some things we didn't talk about here. So if you haven't picked up the DVD on the Methuselah Factor, there's 2 hours of material there that covers what we talked about on Sunday as well as into the material we've been talking about these last few days. Well, there's a special type of work, a special type of exercise that is very beneficial, and it's useful work. Useful work. Because if you're doing something useful, you get more mental satisfaction and more stress-reducing benefits than if you exercise otherwise. Are you aware of this? Think about it. Now, if it's 50 below out and it's all icy out there, I don't want you to go out and break your hip. Don't say Dr. Giroux sent you out there on the icy driveway. But so you're exercising on the treadmill inside. While you're on the treadmill, is it easier to think about all your problems than when you're outside? Of course. It's less engaging. In fact, if you go to the health club, not only will you get to think about your problems on the treadmill, but they probably have the morning news playing, telling you about all about everyone else's problems. Right? I'm not saying don't go to the health club or don't use a treadmill. But I'm saying you add additional benefit if you do things that are useful. You get outside. You engage your mind in doing a task. If it's outside in the summertime, you make vitamin D. You'll get the benefits of fresh air. Now, I like to tell people that there are natural rhythms to life. Have you ever thought much about that? We're actually designed to exercise and then to rest. So after eating, you know what we're kind of programmed to do? Do something less intense. Some of you are illustrating some of that less intense activity by sleeping in the lecture. Well, what happens when you eat, that stimulates your parasympathetic nervous system. That's the part of the nervous system that's involved in rest and digestion. And so it makes it easier for you to fall asleep after the meal. That's why a leisurely walk after the meal, I noticed many of you who ate in the cafeteria, you took a leisurely walk over to the lecture hall. That's commendable. Some are probably still sitting in the cafeteria sleeping. Okay, so you accomplish something. But the interesting thing about this, very interesting thing, is we're not programmed to do heavy mental or physical work right after eating. So there's a rhythm. Now, sometimes you have to do that. But that's not how our body is designed. Natural rhythm of life. A weekly day of rest. How many of you think there's value in that? In the morning series on the Gospel of Mark, we're going to be looking at some of the scientific evidence in favor of keeping the Sabbath. Some very interesting data on this. We may even get to that tomorrow. We'll have to see how much we cover, how quickly. So this idea, this intermittent activity, got me interested in what happens when we do useful work. Have any of you gardened ever? What if you're gardening and you start to get tired? What do? Okay, you take a break. Maybe you do something less intense. Maybe you go in and you get a drink. But many people have this idea, if they're exercising, they just got to keep going, keep going, keep going. Now, some of you ladies say, I don't think that. I found it more common in my male patients. They tell me, well, if I have 30 minutes, I want to get my money's worth. I'm going to, you know, just go as hard as I can for 30 minutes. But that's not what we do if we're doing typical useful work. So I had this interest in useful work and work where you take breaks. I was working with a colleague, now Dr. Harold Meyer at Southern University. He just had a master's at that time when we did this research. But we did a study. We recruited some 30 patients from our community, and we wanted to see if it made a difference if they took rest breaks during their exercise session. So we've got these 30-some people in the prime of life, 45 to 75. My apologies if you're over 75. My apologies if you're under 45. The prime of life has changed for me over the years. I don't know about any of you. But anyway, you may have guessed I'm in that age range. So 31 sedentary individuals, they're going to be randomly assigned by the computer to one of three groups. One group is going to be doing intermittent exercise. That means or interval training. They're going to take breaks throughout their exercise session. The other group is going to spend the exact same amount of time in the gym. We did this in the gym, not in the garden, so we could monitor them carefully. But they're going to be exercising continuously. So they're in the gym for 20 minutes. They're going to just exercise for 20 minutes straight. These people, if they're there for 20 minutes, they're going to take breaks. Maybe every 30 seconds or every minute. I'll show you how we did it in a minute. And then there was a control group. What do you think they did during the 10 weeks? They did nothing. They were sedentary, so they're going to stay sedentary. So let's see what happens. Oh, I didn't put all these details in for you guys. I'll tell you what they did. We started with 20-minute exercise sessions, and what would happen is we did a stress test on all the exercise on all the people to begin with, and we gave them a target heart range. So a goal range for their heart. We gave them these polar monitors that they wore, was recording their heart rate, and the continuous group had to keep their heart rate in that range for the whole 20 minutes. The intermittent group, when they got up to a certain level, they had to stop and take a break until their heart rate fell 10 beats, and then they had to go back to their moderate exercise. You got the picture? So if you watch them, they weren't fit at all. They were sedentary. They'd be exercising for, how long? Maybe just a minute. Their heart rate comes up, and then for 30 seconds or a minute, they're just like doing like a cool down. If they were on the treadmill, they'd taken the grade off the treadmill, and instead of, you know, walking briskly, they're just kind of plodding along until their heart rate comes back down. Every week, we increased their exercise sessions by 3 minutes. The first week, they were going 20 minutes a session. Second week, it was 23 minutes. So at the end of 10 weeks, how long were they exercising for? Some of you say 50 minutes, you're very, very close, but you're wrong. 47 minutes. This is only 9 increases in 10 weeks. Okay? So, but you got the idea. I'm just trying to get you to think in terms of what was going on. I wasn't trying to trick you there. So they get up to about 50 minutes. You're right. That's what they did. Let's see what happens. Here's what happened to fitness. One of the most precise ways of measuring fitness, if not the most precise, is by something called maximum oxygen utilization, VO2 max. And you can see the control group did not improve a bit. How many of you are surprised that their fitness did not improve? No, this is what you'd expect, right? They're doing nothing. This means that they were being compliant. They weren't exercising on the slide. The continuous exercise group and the intermittent group actually both improved significantly. Now, these numbers may look different, but for research purposes, they were the same. So now this is interesting. So they made equal improvement, and they got to rest during their exercise sessions. How many of you think this is good news? Right, it's encouraging to me already. Well, let's see what else happened. We looked at what happened to their weight and to their body fat. Now, this is quite interesting. Maybe not surprising to you. The control group actually gained weight and they gained body fat. How many of you are shocked? No, I mean, not particularly surprising. They gained 3.5 pounds. They gained about 1% in body fat. And you can see the group that exercised continuously, they were significantly better. They were over 5 pounds better off. They lost a couple pounds as opposed to gaining 3.5. Is that good? I mean, sure. I mean, some of you might not think that sounds like much. Remember, we're just talking about exercise alone. They were told not to make any changes in their diet. And as best we could tell, they were compliant with that. They didn't change their diet. So, if you lost 2 pounds, if you have weight to lose, say 2 pounds in 10 weeks, that's nothing, Dr. DeRose. Well, how much is that in a year? I mean, that's 10 pounds in a year. You know, the average American's gaining. If you are losing 10 pounds every year and you're overweight, this could make a huge difference. But now look at the intermittent group. You've all been looking at it already, right? Because I put the picture up there. They lost over twice as much weight, and whereas this group did not lose body fat, this group did. And what was the difference? They were taking more breaks. Now, doesn't this seem crazy to you? But there's actually other research that has shown the same thing. And apparently, most of us, when we're exercising continuously, we're actually doing too much to optimize the burning of fat. Whether that makes sense to you or not, that's what the data suggests. And so if you take short breaks in the midst of your exercise, now we did it very scientifically with pulse rates and all, but here's a practical way you can do it. Whatever you're doing for exercise, if you start getting a little tired, what could you do? Just take a break. Just slow down. If you're walking briskly, just slow down. Well, someone's walking with me, Dr. DeRose. Well, tell them I'm doing intermittent exercise. I got to take a little break. They can walk up and walk back. And, you know, you'll be together again. There's some other benefits to intermittent exercise. It decreases the likelihood of overexercise. You know how many people start on an exercise program and they have to quit? Why? Because they did too much too soon. They threw their back out. Or they twisted their ankle. Just take it easy. Do something every day. If you have questions about whether it's safe for you or not, you know, see your doctor. But if the doctor has said, you know, you've got severe heart disease and congestive heart failure, the doctor told you, you know, not to exercise, don't even go to the grocery store without, you know, sitting in the, you know, motorized cart. Well, I mean, you check with the doctor. Don't say, well, Dr. DeRose said, you know, I should be able to walk a mile. Well, I didn't say that to anybody. Overexercise is actually harmful, though, to blood fluidity. So pushing yourself, by the way, it also suppresses your immune system. Moderate exercise helps your immune system. It helps your blood fluidity. Overdoing it hurts both. You see? Okay, let's take a look at an example. These 10 apparently healthy volunteers in what some people consider the prime of life, 20 to 36, they engaged in intense exercise. Okay? They were not smokers, but they weren't regular exercisers. What did they find? This intense exercise worsened their blood fluidity. The red blood cells weren't as healthy. They couldn't squeeze through the capillaries as well. This means their blood fluidity was getting worse because they did what? They did too much exercise. Well, how do I know? What's too much? What's the right amount? I'm just saying, you know what? You'd be surprised. Just listen to your body. If you only feel like doing 5 minutes or 2 minutes or just walking the dog to the mailbox and back, I mean, it's better than not walking the dog to the mailbox and back. I'm not saying that's adequate, but you get my point. Just start doing something and get in the habit of doing something on a daily basis. Okay, let's move on to another one. Some of you are feeling very persecuted by speaking about exercise and overweight. Now you can feel good because probably most of you are not smokers. So right now you can just pat yourself on the back. If you are a smoker, pat yourself on the back for being here and listening to this stuff. Because there are people in the Adventist Church that smoke. And that's a difficult habit to break. But let me give you some other motivation to quit, or things that you can share with people who may be struggling with nicotine addiction. Smoking worsens blood fluidity. So if you want to worsen your blood fluidity, one of the best things you can do is smoke. It's going to raise the white count. It's going to raise the fibrinogen. And even one cigarette significantly worsens blood fluidity. That's not bad enough. We're speaking especially about mental health and cognitive performance and brain health. Very, very interesting data that's out there about brain health, blood fluidity, and smoking. Let's look at an example of some of the research. 2007 study from Australia. It's a meta-analysis. That means they pooled a whole bunch of studies together to try to come up with some conclusions. They looked at over 25,000 people. These individuals all were being followed up for dementia over a period of up to 30 years. Okay? So they're monitoring cognitive function. Average age of these people, 74. Let's see what they found. At the time they initially assessed these people, if a person was a smoker, current smoker, if you compared them with those who had never smoked, over time they had at this point in time, they had an 80% increased risk of having Alzheimer's and about a similar increased risk of having another common form of dementia called vascular dementia. So that's not caused by an Alzheimer's process, but because of circulatory problems to the brain. And what was it connected with? Smoking. Smoking. When they followed them over time now they're, so that was at one point in time, the smokers had higher risk of finding them having dementia, but now you're going to follow people over time who didn't have dementia or who had some dementia, you're going to see how their cognitive function does. Compared to those who never smoked, the current smokers had an increased rate of decline in their cognitive abilities. We do a test to assess for dementia. That got worse at a faster rate in the smokers. And actually, they had a 70% increased risk of developing Alzheimer's. So the point is, even if a person is doing well cognitively and they're a smoker, they decrease the risk of having problems in the future by doing what? Stopping smoking. Stop smoking. It's the best thing you can do for brain health. They say, but I do it for my brain health, Dr. DeRose, because when I smoke, it helps me relax. Is that true or not? Actually, it's very interesting. I should tell you about this. Nicotine actually is a stimulant. But most every smoker I've worked with has developed a relaxation response in relation to smoking. When they smoke, this is a cue for them to relax. I just finished the job, I'm having a cigarette. I just finished eating, I'm going to relax and have a smoke. So the irony is, the nicotine is raising the stress hormones in the body, but a person is telling themselves, I can relax now. Isn't that interesting? There's another dimension to it that many people don't realize. Nicotine actually has a very short time in which it stays in your bloodstream. So within an hour or two of the previous cigarette, a smoker is already beginning to go through mild withdrawal. What do you think smoking a cigarette does to that withdrawal? It stops it, because you're smoking. So when a smoker says a cigarette helps me relax, biochemically, the cigarette is actually making them more stressed. It's raising stress hormones in the body, but they're giving themselves permission to rest, and it's removing withdrawal. So I tell you all this just to remind you that smoking is actually not good for the brain, even in the short term. It's really not helping individuals. And quitting is one of the best things they can do. I say one of the best things they can do. Of course, it's the best thing they can do with tobacco. But there's other things that are even better to do, especially if they haven't given their life to Jesus, right? Just a few more things, if you needed any more evidence. This is a very famous study from England called the Whitehall Study. And what they found here is they looked at people over time. Average age of 55, if a person was smoking in middle age, they had more problems with memory deficits and decline in reasoning abilities. So remember, we're speaking about mental health, improving cognitive abilities. Likely some of this relates to blood fluidity, but there are likely other factors associated with tobacco smoking that worsen cognitive processes. So you might say, Dr. DeRose, this isn't really all that relevant to us. Well, that's good. If you're not smoking, wonderful. If you've never smoked, beautiful. But there's people in your communities that need to be reminded that there's other reasons to quit smoking besides being afraid of cancer and heart disease. You realize as we get older, people less fear things that kill them than they do things that what? That's right, maim or impair or disable them. And you're looking at one right here, cognitive decline increased with smoking. Well, let's talk about some other things you can do to improve your blood fluidity. Here is a seventh one. That's getting adequate vitamin D year-round. And many of you realize that this is a picture from International Falls, right? No, of course not. This is from places further south. The message here is that vitamin D is important, and we can't make it from sunshine year-round. Since some of you were intrigued by our discussions about weight, and in fact, one of you was asking me about this earlier in the week, we have some material here about it. It actually is in the DVD as well. But if you are overweight, not only does overweight increase these inflammatory compounds that worsen your blood fluidity, but the more you weigh, the harder it is for your body to make vitamin D from sunshine. So, as we get older, by the way, our ability to make vitamin D also deteriorates. So if you don't know what your vitamin D status is, you say, well, I'm out in the sun a lot, Dr. DeRose. You're carrying extra weight. You may have a low vitamin D level, even if you're not carrying extra weight. Very common to have low vitamin D levels. Now, some of you are very fortunate in that you're at very low risk of skin cancer. My skin is quite fair, so I'm at high risk, but I can make vitamin D very efficiently. Now, if you're a darker complexion, you're protected, largely protected from skin cancer, but what do you have great difficulty making? Vitamin D. So the darker your skin, the more likely you are to have vitamin D deficiency. So you should know your vitamin D level. If you don't, you should get it checked because you may be surprised even at this time of year. If it's low, that's worsening your blood fluidity and lowering your immune system, among other things. Okay, I don't think we need to probably talk all that much more about it. This is just a study illustrating it from a few years ago. And the bottom line, all these things track together. Insulin resistance, obesity, lower vitamin D levels, they all kind of go hand in hand. This slide is important, so let's talk about it. This is showing you places in the world and where they cannot make enough vitamin D during the winter months, and for how many months they have a problem in the winter. So let's look at this. Boston, Massachusetts, 42 degrees north latitude. 4 months of the year they cannot make vitamin D. Who knows what their latitude is where they live here in Minnesota? 45, okay. So you're going to be between Boston and Edmonton. So between 4 and 5 months in the middle of the winter, even if it's a sunny day, even if you have, you know, 50 degree weather and you're out in shirt sleeves and you get sunburned, you know, the sun is bouncing off the snow. That must have gotten lots of vitamin D. Actually, you probably got none. The reason why is that ultraviolet B, B like boy, rays, that you need to make vitamin D are actually filtered out very effectively by the atmosphere. And if the sun doesn't come up high enough above the horizon those ultraviolet B rays do not reach us. You can still get a sunburn with the ultraviolet A, but you're not getting the B, ultraviolet B, to make the vitamin D. So for 4 to 5 months out of the year, you need to take a vitamin D supplement. Now, when I was living in Maine, of course, folks there are closer to the ocean than you are. And so they had a habit there. Many of them, the old Mainers, were told to do this. Maybe some of the Minnesotans were told this, too. Did any of you have to do anything unusual in the winter months here growing up? Okay, well, he's being checked. He's got to take vitamin D, he said, all the time. But did any of you have to take cod liver oil when you were growing up? Some of you did. Well, the Mainers knew this, and it was probably just trial and error. They realized the kids didn't get sick when they took that cod liver oil like the other kids. And that's because cod liver oil is a rich source of vitamin D. And so many of the folks that lived there in Maine, grew up there, there for generations, they had to take that nasty stuff during the winter months, and there's a good reason for it. Vitamin D is very important for optimal immune function. Now, the good news today is you don't have to take cod liver oil, because vitamin D you can, you know, readily get in supplement form. Well, the eighth point that we want to talk about is getting adequate sleep at night. We're going to save the last three for tomorrow, because I want to give you a few minutes at least for some questions that you might have. And so that was supposed to inspire you to go to bed on time tonight, so that you won't sleep during the lecture. And I'll tell you one other thing, since I know some of you can only come intermittently, and I know some of you have been confused about some of the different resources. The resources that go along with this talk are, this series, are these two. So this one, they have, we have these, you know, on special this week, I told you. So the Methuselah Factor Longevity Plus, that's actually spelled correctly on the DVD. I think I told some of you that was an earlier draft that I meant to correct again here. And then I also brought some of these along. You say, this Dr. DeRose looks very unofficial. Now, I don't know what you think of this jacket. Some of you may like the jacket, others of you may not. But the camera did not like this jacket. I was wearing this very same jacket when we filmed two presentations on brain health when I was in Phoenix earlier this year. And this jacket has, I think they call it a moiré pattern. Do you know what that is? Where it looks like I'm hooked up to a neon light. I'm exaggerating. But it kind of, every time I move, it kind of flashes. Now, some of you think that it should be a premium DVD that we actually have that. But I didn't feel that was the best quality. And the other thing, really weird, I've never seen this anywhere else, but on that one, the first, that's the second hour, you get the special jacket effect. The first hour on the DVD, there was some weird problem with the computer, where if you were looking at the slide and it looked really sharp, it would slowly fade out over a second or two and then get sharp again. It does that whether I'm speaking up front, what was the feed that was going to the computer. So we decided, no, we can't, you know, make a whole bunch of these professionally with those things. But most people, if your vision is bad, you wouldn't know the difference anyway. It would just help keep you awake. But so we didn't bring as many of those, and that's why I'm letting you know that if you're here. I think we only brought like 25 of those, and they're just a special, you know, $6 pricing, which the ABC said that's the standard price they charge for a DVD of talks here. So that's what those are. That's why they don't have the fancy packaging. But if you want all the material that we're covering, it's going to be on the 2 hours of DVD here plus the 2 hours of DVD here. So that covers this whole series. And if you're going to the talk in the morning, that's this series here. These are the 8 30-minute presentations, Healing Insights from the Gospel of Mark. And if you were here Sunday, these are the things we covered Sunday. So 3 presentations on Sunday, 2 hours of those presentations on this, and then 2 on this. 2 talks, but 1 hour on that. Okay, so for those of you who are asking what's there, why are there so many DVDs, that's supposed to answer that question. So hopefully I've saved 3 questions right now. Okay? Any other questions in our final few minutes? We'll take about 5 minutes. And Ed, are you equipped to help us out with a roving microphone? Okay. I wasn't trying to wake you up. Ed is one of the sharper learners. You know, he saw that getting adequate sleep and he decided to get it right now while the getting was good. I thought maybe you had that covered for me. Okay. So we've got a couple of hands over here that we'll take. Got to get Ed's attention too. Keep your hand up so he sees who's got questions. Oh my. He was wooed away by the being on that side of the auditorium. How much vitamin D? Typically, to keep your level stable, you need in the range of 2,000 international units a day. That's just to keep your level where it's at. If you're vitamin D deficient, we'll give anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 units a day. Sometimes we just prescribe a single 50,000 international unit pill per day. Now, that may sound like huge amounts of vitamin D, but international units, even though they sound big, they're only referring to micrograms. It's tiny amounts compared to what you might take in a vitamin C pill, for example. Yeah, a microgram is 1/1000th of a milligram, and a milligram is 1/1000th of a gram, and there's 454 grams in a pound.
Should you take D3 or D2? And what kind of D3 or D2?
Okay, should you take D3 or D2? Vitamin D3 is almost always extracted from an animal source. It could come from fish. It could come from lanolin, which is the fat in the wool of sheep. And so some people say, but Dr. DeRose, I'm a vegan. I don't want to have anything from animal sources. Well, you could take vitamin D2. D2 is from a plant source. The catch is this. Vitamin D3 is absorbed better, and vitamin D3 is the D that your body makes. So D2 is similar. They seem to work similarly for bone health. But there's some lingering questions in some of our minds, myself included, as to whether vitamin D2 is fully equivalent to D3. Some people think there's no question. They're both equivalent. It doesn't matter. Other people say, well, if I'm going to take vitamin D, I might as well take what my body makes. That's vitamin D3. Some people, including Dr. Winston Craig. Some of you were talking about Dr. Craig. He's one of the leading nutritionists in the Adventist Church, many years there at Andrews University, PhD in biochemistry, if I'm not mistaken. And he's sat on many of these international panels on nutrition. He's a firm believer in the Bible and spirit of prophecy. He feels that vitamin D3 is so purified, no matter where it's from, you're just getting vitamin D3. You don't need to worry about whether it's from sheep or fish. If that's good enough for you, that's fine. If it's not, well, that's okay too. Okay, I'm just trying to, you know, give you kind of a balanced look at that. Who's got the mic now?
The one thing I wanted to know was about thyroid. You started saying, I got two questions, so I'm going to answer it right away. The next one was about bone health with D. Well, how about calcium and boron?
Okay. And what's your third question?
The third one is about peanut butter. I hear we shouldn't eat it because it's got a lot of mold.
A lot of mold. Oh, okay. Okay, let's talk about all these three questions quickly. We'll talk about them in reverse order, and then you'll see if my memory is still working or not. The last one had to do with peanuts and mold. It is true that peanuts are susceptible to mold growth, and the particular product that we're concerned about is something called aflatoxin. It can affect other things like grains, and the aflatoxin is a liver carcinogen. You know, Ellen White told us that she actually endorsed peanuts, but she said almonds were better choice than peanuts. So I'm very glad to be in a forward-thinking conference where I noticed for breakfast they're not only serving soy milk, but not serving peanut milk, but almond milk. So they need to be commended here. So yes, if you're worried about the peanuts, you can have almonds and walnuts. I still have some peanuts and peanut butter. If I succumb to liver cancer, you'll know I wasn't careful enough. I'm not making light of it, but if you make your own, of course, you don't have to worry about it. Just make sure they're not moldy. But the factories are not so careful. There are standards. If they're shipping the peanut butter across state lines, they have to meet higher standards than if it's just within the state. So that's some level of protection there. As far as vitamin D, your question about vitamin D, calcium, bone health. Yes, bone health, there's a number of factors. If any of you have osteoporosis, I do have a handout, I think it's about 5 pages long, on natural things that you can use for osteoporosis. It includes everything from boron to weighted vests to other supplements. Calcium is important, but let me tell you this. There's growing concerns about just willy-nilly taking calcium supplements. Some concerns in men that if you're just taking calcium just to take it, you may be increasing your risk of prostate cancer, although some think it's mainly a dairy effect. But there's clearly an association between dairy intake and prostate cancer. There may be an association with just taking extra calcium. There's no evidence that I've seen that this, if you eat more greens, that you're going to have a problem. But taking supplements of calcium or milk are prostate cancer risk factors. And in women, taking more calcium may be a heart disease risk factor. So if your bone health is low, you need to get adequate calcium. Yes, take it. But don't just say, well, because I'm a woman, I'm taking 2,000 milligrams of calcium a day and 5,000 international units of vitamin D, and I'm taking boron because I don't want to have osteoporosis. Well, if your bone health is fine, whatever you're doing is probably fine. You see? So don't just, what I'm just saying is don't take it for no other reason. Calcium, magnesium, potassium can all help leg cramps as well. So I tried to answer all your three questions as best I could. If I didn't do justice, you can talk with me individually. One more question here I think we'll get in before we finish.
You noted that smoking worsens blood fluidity. Does the same relationship hold for electronic tobacco and marijuana use?
Oh, okay, that's a very good question about e-cigarettes and marijuana. I can't tell you I've seen a study of blood fluidity in marijuana use, but we know there's carcinogens in marijuana, and actually one of my biggest concerns with marijuana is the one we've been talking about with these other substances like caffeine and alcohol, and that is the moral effects. Marijuana has a blunting effect on the will. In fact, people that are chronic marijuana users in the literature have been reported as having an amotivational syndrome. What that means in plain English is they lose their motivation. And you say, well, I knew that when I was smoking marijuana. I didn't want to do it. Everything was good. Well, that can, even after all the marijuana is out of their system, they can have that residual effect. So I do not recommend it for some of those reasons. My guess would be it probably worsens blood fluidity. As far as the e-cigarettes, there is data coming out looking at them that is of concern. I can't tell you I've seen something that looks just at blood fluidity, but nicotine being a stimulant does cause your blood vessels to constrict. It does impair blood flow just on that basis alone. So any nicotine delivery system is going to impair circulation. Whether it's changing fibrinogen levels, I don't know. My guess would be it probably does raise white count, but there may be other constituents in tobacco smoke that do that. Okay, well, thanks for the good questions. We'll try to give more time for questions and answers tomorrow afternoon, but let's close with a word of prayer. Father in heaven, you've given us light to try to be a blessing to us. It involves us cooperating with you. And yet the encouraging message that we've tried to touch on is you don't point things out in our life to make us feel worse, but you point things out because you want to help us and bless us. And so we thank you that that's your motivation. And as we speak about health, you're not only seeking to bless us, you're seeking to bless our families and our churches and our communities. Help us internalize the very things that we need to learn. Help us get motivated to do a little better in areas maybe where we've been slack, and help us to realize that we don't have to do it on our own, but again, that you're inviting us to come press closer to you and allow you to give us victory in our lives and help us in our walk to better health. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.